Hi, everyone. Classroom teachers, you know, when we're in the classroom, we're constantly trying to figure out ways to unlock students' excitement and emotion about learning. And how you go about doing that is obviously different from one classroom to another, one teacher to another. But we also know that there are a lot of standard day-to-day pressures that seemingly take time away from allowing us to be more creative and hands-on with our students. I've also talked to a lot of teachers recently about the idea that students are starting to use AI as a crutch to sort of get through problems rather than thinking through them creatively themselves. And so that's certainly one of those pressures that maybe in some ways could diminish our ability to be as creative as we want to with our students. Finding ways to promote creative endeavors and learning is potentially a counteracting force to a lot of these pressures, but how do you go about doing that? That's what we'll be discussing on today's Teaching Matters podcast.
Welcome to Teaching Matters, a podcast exploring all things teaching and learning. Teaching Matters is produced by NPR affiliate WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio. And here is your host, Dr. Scott Titsworth, Dean of the Scripps College of Communication at Ohio University.
Thanks so much, Trinity. Joining me today is Susan Riley. She's the founder of the Institute for Arts Integration and STEAM, the world's largest online professional development provider for teachers and others who use an arts-integrated approach. Susan is a former music educator and administrator, and she's also the author of a new book titled Creativity's Edge, Unleashing Humanity's Greatest Advantage in the Age of AI. Susan, it's great to meet you. I'm excited to talk with you today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
So I think I just want to start by letting listeners sort of understand who you are and your background. So I noted that you were a music educator. You know, how did you grow up as a teacher and what got you into the field? And what got you excited about creativity? I'm sure it's partly your music background, but you were also a teacher, and I'm sure that propelled you even more.
Absolutely. So I actually started, I was a farm kid. I grew up on a dairy farm in Pennsylvania where we didn't have a whole lot, right? But we did have a piano in our house, and I kind of grew up with music surrounding me. Mm-hmm. And I had a teacher in elementary school who kind of noticed that this might be a talent that I had access to, and she kind of flourished that with me. And by the time I got through high school, I realized I really wanted to kind of merge the ideas of teaching and music. And so I went to Westminster Choir College to learn how to be a music teacher. Had a wonderful start, taught music ed for 10 years in various elementary schools, Title I, as well as affluent communities, kind of ran the gamut. And when I was about 10 years in, I started on my master's degree in educational leadership because I thought, you know what? I'm seeing these kids who are flourishing in the music room that are still struggling in the academic classroom. And I knew they could do really well, but others weren't seeing it. And I wanted to advocate for using the arts in some capacity. And I didn't have language around what that was until I was in my grad program. And I had thought, if nobody's going to listen to me as a music teacher, maybe they'll listen to me as an administrator. So I kind of took that pathway. And during that season, I was able to research what arts integration was. It kind of came up as a part of a research project that I was working on. I stumbled across it and I thought, this is what we've been talking about. We just didn't have language around it. I wonder if I could bring this to our school. And I had this amazing principal who was willing to allow us to try new things at that time and not really micromanage us a whole lot. And so I brought it to him and I said, you know, I got to do a thesis project anyway as a leadership piece. Could I bring this to our school? And honestly, Scott, it shouldn't have worked because arts integration, when we study it for the last 40 years, the advantages are really for students who are disadvantaged across the board, whether it's socioeconomic or if it's some sort of special needs that they have or English language learners. And at that time, the school that I was in, we didn't have a whole lot of that. We were a neighborhood school, fairly affluent. And so he was like, is this really going to work? Like, why do you even want to try this? And I said, yeah, but the data, if you really look at it, the kids who are just kind of floating along for us, not the ones who are struggling, not our gifted and talented, but the ones who are right in the middle, they're declining. Has anybody else noticed this? They're kind of declining across the board. So why not give this a shot? So we did. I started with all of our team leaders at that school. We kind of did a pilot program. And at the end of the year, we saw a 20% increase in both reading and math scores for those mid-level kids. And we started to see everybody else increase as well. So I noticed it at that period of time, this is working, and we documented it. And I started a blog to kind of let everybody know, here's what we're doing. We're sharing that with the world. That ended up becoming the Institute. Mm-hmm. We took it from there. It kind of snowballed, and that was 2009, 2010. Mm. And we've been rocking ever since.
That's a great story. It's interesting the way that you describe that. Back in the day, I did a little bit of my own exploration about arts education, not a degree like you did, but I did some reading on it. I thought it was really interesting. And you're right. In some cases, it almost looks like it's meant to be an intervention, right, for certain types of students. But then, you know, if you think about, I'm not a real adherent to the concept of learning styles, the way that it's typically studied and talked about. But if you think about art integration, it's just mm-hmm. another modality of a way of understanding discrete subjects, you know, whether it is social studies, mathematics, science. When arts become a part of that, it's just another lens through which students can understand that. Of course, you know, STEAM became a word, right? But what I hear you saying is that arts integration really isn't something that should be thought of as being special, except for the fact that it's a really great way for students to learn. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, it's an application of learning. So, and the same for STEAM, right? It's an intentional use across standards of an arts standard and another content area merging in a way that makes sense, that's natural. So you're not going to use it all the time, but it's a great way to integrate your concepts, discrete skills that you've taught, and pull them together in a new way. Because all humans have an arts access point. No matter what it is, even if you think you're not creative, I guarantee you, you are in some capacity. You have a resonance for some sort of arts area. If it's, you know, dancing your heart out on a dance floor, or if it's singing in the shower, it doesn't really matter. You've got a place to hook in. And so do our students. So it makes sense that the things that they want to come to school for, the things that they love, we hook in, and when it's intentional and natural to do so, and allow them to apply that in a different way, and perhaps take a look at our content areas in a different way that they've seen before, it also solidifies those concepts much more deeply. Yeah. It allows them to run with it and to problem solve in a different way rather than rote memorization. It's good for all of us.
Kind of sticking with this sort of definitional discussion. So, you know, there could be a risk that if a person's listening to the podcast or just trying to learn about this more, they might reduce this idea of art education to creating pictures and, you know, the product that is created. Yeah. Art's more, it's even in some ways more important to talk about art as a creative process.
Yes.
How do you define what that process is from your perspective?
So there's a difference between arts integration and arts education. And one of the things that, in fact, one of the groups that really are most nervous about arts integration are arts educators. They're concerned, is this going to take our jobs, or are they diluting our art form? And as a music educator myself, that's something that I'm very concerned about, right? It's not. In fact, authentic arts integration, when it's done right, I always think that the arts educators are our MVPs, right? Because they have the skill set. They know how to teach those discrete skills in the arts areas to be applied. Remember, this is an application of learning. It's not just the only way, the direct instructional component. So you still have to learn those discrete skills in the math classroom as well as in the art classroom. And so what we want is to be able to apply those and to focus on that process. The end product is really, like, when I'm in the music classroom, yes, I want to get to that end product. I'm focused on the process to get there. But yeah, I want that concert to be really great, right? In an arts integrated classroom and an environment, what we're focused on is the process of using the arts themselves as and the skills that are required to do that, and applying that to the skill set and process of the other content area that you're addressing as well.
Yeah, just briefly from my perspective, I've started to read more about the art process, and I'm not an artist. I mean, I dabble with playing guitar, and I was a decent drummer at one point. I do woodworking. I do all these things that, you know, have artistic output, but I don't consider myself an artist in that sense. But the whole idea of being able to do any of those things, in addition to, like, my job has a lot of data visualization involved in it and a lot of presentations, and that idea of the creative process that artists go through in creating their art, I found to become so much more relevant to so many aspects of my life, even though I would not define myself as an artist. You know what I'm saying? So I think that, you know, the point you're making is really good. And then, you know, to the other point that you made, when I do want to, you know, heighten my game, I go to people that are artists. I go to people that are practicing musicians to ask them questions about certain guitar techniques or, you know, other things like that. I totally get the point that you're making. Let me switch gears a little bit. So at the start of the podcast, you know, I mentioned that I think many teachers would say that they want their classrooms to have creative aspects to it, but it's also something that doesn't necessarily happen automatically just because you want it to happen, right? There are barriers to it. You even mentioned one that I think is really interesting. I read about this on your website about issues related to socioeconomic and poverty and how that could become a barrier potentially for being able to talk, you know, being able to integrate sort of this creative process. Can you sort of talk through and unpack what some of those potential barriers are that teachers might be facing who, you know, want to be able to do this, but they just find it hard?
Sure. There's definitely some easy kind of low-hanging fruit here that we can talk about that I think almost every teacher is going to face. One, yes, differences in terms of socioeconomic climate, whether you're in a Title I school or if you're in a fluent school, that definitely plays a role. In fact, when the thesis of the book that I actually was thinking about was, if we know that things like arts integration and STEAM work, we have decades of evidence that they do, why is it not something that is more prevalent in schools? And if you ask anybody, the first answer that they're going to give you is standardized testing. In fact, we ran that poll a lot, right? Like I'm constrained by the tests that I have to give. And so I don't have time. So testing time is often a barrier. I have this curriculum that I have to get through. Many teachers are still facing pacing guides, which is so antiquated, but it's part of, you know, what we see a lot, in terms of matter of control. So we have some of those barriers that are being set, but honestly, when you dig into the research, the thing that sets one school apart from another is money. It's the access to money, because we value what we put our money behind. And so when schools don't have access to grant funding or other additional money aspects, whether their school boards just decide this is not of value to us and we're going to put the money elsewhere, that's a big barrier for people, because in terms of investment in something like arts integration or in creativity, even when we're thinking about creative classrooms, the practical reality is that it costs something, right? It costs money to hire arts educators to have explicit arts classrooms, right? In order to be able to teach during those subject areas. And it also costs money in order to bring teaching artists in and these opportunities for students to experience creativity. Even when we're talking in a classroom about things all the way down to how a classroom is decorated, right? I'm not one for, I'm not a big believer, and the research does not show that a huge classroom with lots of decorations and entertainment is more effective than another. It's not. But there is something to be said about cultivating a creative environment and being able to access tools that allow you to do that. And that comes down to money. So those are typical barriers that we see: money, time, the mindset of those who are in leadership about old mindsets about what's valuable now to be investing our time in for curriculum. Breaking through some of those barriers can be a challenge, but it's not insurmountable. There's lots of things that we can do, and even things that don't cost a whole lot that make a big difference.
So sort of, you know, pulling on that thread a little bit more, I mean, you know, the basis of your institute is to help teachers sort of pull on, you know, some of these ideas. Yeah. What are some of the basic steps, like when you're talking with teachers and, you know, they're saying, I really want to do this, I just don't know how to get started. What are some of the best initial steps to sort of start going down this path?
Yeah, I like to start with small strategies. You want to get a quick win, right? Mm-hmm. And the easiest way to do that is with some simple visual thinking strategies that can actually be applied in a lot of different ways. Visually, yes, but also in all of the arts modalities. So we can have dance and theater and media arts be applied here as well. But you're thinking small, right? We don't want a big project that's going to take 9 weeks. We don't want something that feels overwhelming. This is something you could do in 5 to 10 minutes. So, for example, a strategy like See, Think, Wonder. This is a very simple but really effective strategy where you start by just observing everything you possibly can about something that you're looking at or something that you're listening to. You can use multiple modalities here. But the key is to slow down and actually write down just what you're seeing or what you're hearing. And this is, you would be surprised at how hard this is for our students, for our teachers, because we're so used to constantly going, right? Everything is about how fast can you get to the answer. But when you slow down, you start to observe things that you didn't see before. And you start to think a little bit more about, oh, if I missed that, where else might I be looking? You get curious, right? And creativity and curiosity are inextricably linked. So once you slow down and you really start to notice things, then you can start to ask the question, okay, what do you think is going on in this whatever image you're looking at or song you're listening to or even a problem that's on the board? If you're in a math class and you've got a word problem, you can break it down. What do you see here? What are the explicit things that you're seeing in this problem? What do you now think about this? And then what questions come up? What do you wonder? Yeah. Where did that come from? How did that evolve? Think about this in a social studies classroom. I mean, you could start with an image of, you know, from a photograph from the Vietnam War and begin just by looking at it. Slow down. Don't talk about it. Look at it. Really focus on those things. What are some things that then come up for you and questions that you can dig into? Something like that can be done in 5 minutes. And it's really effective in terms of igniting the creative process for our students and getting them to merge from, you know, whatever was going on in the hallway before you came in to getting you prepped and ready to learn in that classroom for that period of time. Something like that is a great way to get started. Mm-hmm.
I love how you know, as you were describing through that scenario, it immediately sort of started to bleed into not just an internal process, but it became verbal as you start asking questions and potentially even having dialogue with others. Yeah. I bring that up because one of my, one of my heroes is John Dewey, who we often think of, you know, as being the education philosopher. He had a great book, though, titled Art as Experience, where he actually talked about some of these concepts that you just went through. And I always say that most of the answers, if you get asked a question, what could we do better? The answer is John Dewey, right? And so I always have him as my fallback answer to questions like that. But I love how you describe that in a way that is so, you know, opening up the classroom for discourse based upon observation. And you're right, that is a creative process of being able to do that well. Let's switch gears to what has undoubtedly become the big elephant in the room. Artificial intelligence has taken over already so much of what it is that we do. And in some cases, it's really obvious. Students going on to ChatGPT to figure out, how should I write this? Or how can I create this image rather than taking my own photograph? And a lot more subtle ways that it's integrating into our lives that, you know, maybe we're not even fully aware of. What's your take on AI? Is it a crutch? Is it a resource? My guess is you're going to say the answer is both, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. But, you know, your book is really focusing on this idea of creativity in the age of AI. And so it's a big variable, you know, that we're all dealing with right now.
Yeah. AI is it's such a complicated mess, right? Especially right now. It's moving so fast. There are so many things that are happening that it's kind of like you're a deer in headlights. Where do I even begin to look? Is it a crutch? Sure. Is it an opportunity? Yes. What we have to look at as educators and know is that it's not going away. I mean, we can't sit here and say, I wish it didn't come in. This is not something our students should be using. We should just not focus on it. You can't. It's changed the world forever now. And so we need to now get to a place of thinking about what is it that AI does and how can we partner with that and discern that and be wise about how we do that. It might be selecting multiple AI tools rather than relying on one, learning how to prompt it, what questions are worth asking it, what questions should you never put in there, how is that evolving in terms of the ethics conversation. There is a lot of richness here that we can focus on in terms of looking at how to engage students in dialogue around AI, because these are not going to be the ones that are just consuming it. They are going to be the student, the people who are creating it. So they should be the ones knowing, okay, what ethical boundaries exist, what don't exist, what should, how can we create those things? And then understanding that AI is going to replace a lot of the things that we're currently doing, mundane tasks that we do no longer need. And that's okay. What that means, though, is that we need to prepare our students for a reality where that exists, so that they are prepared to create forward. Something to remind ourselves about AI is that it's constantly working from behind. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. I've experienced this quite a bit as somebody who presents a lot and shares a lot of information pretty freely. There are times that I will go to conferences and I will see my work up on screens and it's never credited, right? Mm-hmm. Or I will see huge swaths of my writing in somebody else's stuff, right? And it's gross. We don't like that. We teach against that kind of copyright. And people will often ask me, don't you get upset about that? And I used to, but then I reminded myself, that's all stuff that I did previously. You're working from behind, right? Yeah. I have my brain and my creativity, and I'm constantly looking forward. You have no idea what I'm going to create next. So go ahead and take that stuff because I'm moving forward. The same is true of AI. AI is only as good as what we've previously done. And so what we have as an advantage is that it doesn't know what we can create next. That is inherently human. I talk about the creative moat in the book about the three I's, which are integration, intention, and innovation. And these are the three things that AI cannot do. It cannot integrate, not truly. It can fake it, right? There's a surface mm-hmm. level of that, but it really can't make the deep connections that humans make. It cannot innovate. It can only regurgitate. That's as best as it can do, and try to splice it together. And it's not intentional. Humans have these three eyes that if we cultivate that, and these are inherent to creative practices, these are the things that are going to set our students forward and allow them to have success. And then at the same time, learn how to work with the AI tools that we have in order to be a partnership.
I always like to ask this question with people like you that have thought deeply about this. Are there certain AI tools that you really love to use?
Yes, and for different purposes. I think Claude is a great tool when it comes to writing and research. Gemini is coming up as a great research, deep thinking research tool. It can find things that Claude can't. I still like using ChatGPT for some basic stuff that if I'm looking for a process. Today, for example, I was in an Airtable and I needed it to help me with a function because I didn't know how to pull the function together. ChatGPT gave me a step-by-step directions on how to do that. That's great. And Perplexity, I really enjoy for, again, research and citations. I find that a more trustworthy AI tool right now. If I'm putting my trust into it, might be Claude and Perplexity right now, but they're all evolving. And knowing what AI tool to use for what purpose is also really important.
Yeah, that is sort of like a secret sauce right now once you figure that out. And you named all the ones that I also, use for different purposes. I've recently, well, not recently, I mean, it's been around, for a while now, but I think Google's Notebook LM is really interesting, especially for educators.
Yes.
When I'm just thinking about building classes for the next academic year and in addition to all the normal things that you would do in putting a class together, I'm thinking about creating an LM notebook that I would share with my students for us to all use that as a resource. So I think your point's really good. And it goes back to one of your eyes, be intentional about what you're doing and understand why you're using it. I think that's really important. Sticking with AI just for a second further, one of the things that I do find interesting, especially about generative AI, is that, when we when we experience it in our lives, a lot of times right now, it's the social media things that we see. And, you know, we sort of reduce generative AI to creating really crazy dog videos that you see on Facebook and X and things like that. And yet at the same time, you know, in my college, I've got students and faculty in our communication design program that are being very intentional about certain use cases of generative AI that they would integrate into publications. So just recently, I'll kind of hold this up so you can see it. I mean, they use it to create things like this in addition to the tools that they always used in graphic layout and design. So I say that in a long-winded way that, you know, generative AI is becoming a creative tool for people who want to be creative. Have you started to see how that's evolving as a tool? In other words, you know, whether it's from your background in music, where of course you can now create songs, you know, using AI, or, you know, all of these other resources like Nano Banana. How do you think that AI fits in as a tool as part of that creative process that you've been describing?
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've been working with SCAD a bit in terms of our upcoming conference. And one of the things that the directors at SCAD told me that was alarming was that many of their design students, right, like the level one designers are almost irrelevant at this point with generative AI, because basic design work can be done with generative AI. What can't be done though is the next level, like the level two, level three designers that push that boundary, that have the iteration, the thought in their head that they can then design. So yes, the AI tools are definitely coming along. They are getting really good at replacing the basics. But I'll tell you what, Scott, I've used them for like project design or trying to create, you know, visual ads for various things, or even putting together programs. And it's still, it looks weird. It looks funky. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like there's a long way to go. I'm not saying that it's not coming. Sora 2 has just taken off light years. Agentic AI and how that looks for how we're seeing humans actually being very difficult to discern whether this is AI or not. It's coming. But again, I don't think it's going to replace it. It's a matter of using it for partnership and the mundane tasks that used to take us forever in certain design aspects. I think these can be a good tool to get started. But again, the innovative piece of it, that's still going to be human driven.
I've heard a lot of people use analogies that, you know, a few years ago they were saying that having AI tools that you work with was like having sort of like a high school kid that's shadowing you, that's helping out in the margins, and then it became sort of the college level intern, and you know, now there are use cases where it feels much more like a collaborative partner that you're still overseeing. I think those are all interesting ways of describing it. Let's switch gears a little bit. One of the things that I think is interesting in, you know, reading through some excerpts from your book is the way that you think about the students themselves as being a resource for creativity. And I'm thinking about, you know, the ways that students can unlock their own assets, where they live, the region that they're part of, maybe a sort of a place-based understanding about how that becomes part of a creative process. So can you kind of talk about how teachers might think about these hidden assets that are actually potentially very valuable resources for creativity that might be sitting in their classroom unknown at this point?
Yeah, I think when we're talking about our students, and we sometimes think that they're just vessels of knowledge for us to impart things in, but that's so not true, right? They come to us with a variety of different experiences. And when we leverage those experiences, not only do they want to come to class, right? Not only do they desire to be a part of the conversation, it adds a richness and a new learning opportunity for everyone there, including us as the educators. It elevates everything. It's one of the things that a hallmark of STEAM, it's one of the things that sets it apart, is that STEAM is kind of like arts integration in that you connect the arts with the STEM content areas, but it is surrounding a project that is meaningful for that particular student or student group or your school. So when you're working on a STEAM project, it's all about asking an essential question that needs to be solved, looking for a problem. But that problem can't be solving the water crisis in Africa. You can't do that as a elementary school in Maryland, right? But you might have a hunger problem in your community, or that a place where food sourcing is difficult, and you can create a hydroponics lab or a hydroponics garden in your at your school that could solve that and work with local food banks to support the needs of your own community. And so what that does is that it allows students to make a difference in their own community, to empower them to do that. And I often call it hard fun. It's the area, that edge of just enough challenge to make it worth it, not too much to make it so hard that it's difficult, and to find that space where it's enjoyable, right? And so when you're bringing all of those elements together, it just makes school a place that everybody wants to be.
I think you covered some of the additional questions that I had prepped out, but I think where I want to end, as I was looking through the Institute's website, obviously it's focused on, you know, in many respects on teachers, but there's also, you know, it looks to me like you also are trying to help people envision how this arts perspective is relevant, not just in the classroom, but in our personal lives, our professional lives, even if we're not educators. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We have this weird thinking around creativity that it's only for creative individuals, right? It's only for people who are master artists. Mm-hmm. And that's false. Let's just get rid of that. There's more to creativity than just that one branch. In fact, we have something called the four branch framework, that creativity is, there's more than that. That's one branch, is art skills, but then there's also arts application. It's being able to apply that, and you can use that every day. There's also creative thinking. So lateral thinking, divergent thinking, convergent thinking, and building those skills. And then there's creative expression, how we live and move in the world, and what we bring to the table, as well as how we collaborate with others, because creativity doesn't live in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And so one of the mantras that I live by is create before you consume. And even something that small can impact your full day. So before you get out of bed, or when you get out of bed, don't go scrolling the internet to consume in front of you. Think about a way that you can experience the creative practice. It might be the way you make breakfast in the morning, or it could be journaling, or it could be something that feeds us as individuals, because we are creative beings. We were creating before we learned how to feed ourselves. And when you think about that, when you really think about that, that means that it's something that is inherent to who we are as humans, and we need to cultivate it. And so finding ways, small ways to do that for yourself, whether it's, you know, if that's something as small as going on a walk and noticing the, you know, the cardinals that are out in the middle of winter, or investing in, you know, going back and getting some piano lessons because you just really loved it as a kid and it's something that lit you up and you would love to do that again. Mm-hmm. Finding the thing that the creative access point that you have, and then cultivating that and committing to doing that for yourself. We know there's health benefits to it, there's life benefits to it, and certainly it impacts our careers as well. So just go do it. It's important.
Susan, it's been so wonderful getting a chance to meet you, and you're such a tremendous advocate for not just the arts, but the arts process and how it has relevance. So thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. My guest today has been Susan Riley. She's the founder of the Institute for Arts Integration in STEAM, and also has a new book coming out that is titled Creativity's Edge, Unleashing Humanity's Greatest Advantage in the Age of AI. If you look in the text accompanying the podcast, we'll have a link to Susan's website where you can find out more information about the book, and we'll also have a link to the Institute so that you can learn more about the resources that the Institute provides. So just check out the text of the podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. We really appreciate you spending time with us. Thanks to April Koska and Trinity Suite for the work they do behind the scenes. If you want to reach out to the podcast, all you need to do is email us at teachingmatterspodcast@ohio.edu. The first part of that's all one word and all lowercase. Thanks so much for your time, and we hope you all have a great day.